Welcome back, Raw Thoughts listeners, to yet another week, another individual, and another story to be told. This individual, I'm very excited to see where our conversation goes. Everybody knows kind of from my past episodes, being a first responder, really the mental health within this industry is something that I strive for. I have actually started a second series with Mindbase. They were on episode 28. So if you want to go back and listen to episode 28 with Mindbase, you'll kind of learn a little bit more about how we are trying to change the stigma and trying to change the culture within the first responder realm of asking for help. So lo and behold, I have Connor Bates. So a little bit about him is, you know, kind of prior paramedic, and that's where you and I relate a lot. And you're here to tell your story.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm not really sure exactly where to start.
Yeah.
I guess I can kind of back up to high school and kind of what I wanted to do when I grew up.
Yeah.
I didn't really know, I guess, where I wanted to go with things. I always had this desire to learn about medicine and really liked science and things like that. And I started out wanting to be a physical therapist because I had had lots of orthopedic injuries from sports and things like that. And really, I kind of just got bored. I started out at Boise State and did a lot of work with local physical therapists that had worked on me. And the excitement for me was being able to bring someone back to sports or to whatever it is that they love faster, because that's what they did for me. But the more I worked in it, the more I realized I needed more excitement. So I loved swimming, and my family had all been in the military. So I thought, hey, why not go in the Coast Guard and be a rescue swimmer? So that stopped really pretty fast. I got into MEPS and found out that I couldn't get in because of medical issues. And I remember going home that day and just being crushed when I sat down to tell my dad. Because my dad had been in the military for 30 years. And so I wanted to make him proud. And my brother was in. So I was like, hey, I'll do this. And then it didn't happen. So I still remember sitting on my bed that day being like really upset. Like, I just let everybody down. I'm not going to get to do this. What am I going to do now?
Yeah.
So that kind of led to a friend of mine at Eagle Fire Department, Ben Moores, encouraged me to come out and try out to be a volunteer. So went through that program, got in, and at 19 years old, I went through the Eagle Fire Academy to be a volunteer. And then I spent roughly 6 years with the department, working as a third at times, working for full-time guys when they were sick or, you know, whatever. And I rotated through all the different stations, and it was really fun. I learned a lot. Went from knowing nothing to having to grow up pretty fast, run calls, and got my EMT when I was there. So you learn really fast when you're 19 and don't know anything. And
yet you're still trying to help everybody. Like, they're looking for you. They're right. Like, you're the one that has the answers. And you're like, I'm 19. I haven't even experienced life yet.
Right. That was the cool part about the department. Those guys did a great job about taking the volunteers and helping us kind of grow in to be firefighters and be reliable as thirds to have each other's backs. So I learned a lot about life. I learned a lot about medicine. And I learned a lot about just all of it when I was there. That kind of took me into my next job when I started out at Air St. Luke's as an EMT on the ground team there. And I was still at Eagle Fire working as a volunteer when I got on Air St. Luke's. And I got a lot of really great experience when I was there. I think I'll fast forward and then I'll come back.
Okay.
As you know, when you go through paramedic school, you have this huge book and all these things to learn, and very little time to do it.
Yep.
And there's a lot of things that you just can't pick up. So my time at Air St. Luke's was extremely helpful. I made some great friends there, and I learned a ton. I got the benefit of doing ground transports from hospital to hospital, but also working with like the MATCH team and the critical care team and getting to help and assist them. I got to help with some deliveries, got to take care of, you know, tiny NICU babies and some like really sick legitimate patients and see how these teams work together. And that experience was phenomenal. Yeah. Especially with, I think, the maternal fetal side of the things and the tiny neos and stuff like that. That was really helpful when I became a paramedic, because you just don't get that much experience through school or through your clinicals with those kinds of patients. So that was really beneficial, I thought, to me. And while I was working at Air St. Luke's, I just had this desire to keep going. I still wanted that excitement that I'd been kind of chasing. And so I transferred over to Ada County Paramedics as a volunteer over there. And I started out just as a third on the ambulance as a volunteer. And at the same time, I was still working at Air St. Luke's full-time, and I was still working at Eagle Fire Department as a volunteer. And I had had kind of some different times where I had to take a hiatus from all the departments because of injuries and things, but I was towards the end there, I was at all three. And I had gotten married to my wife, Kylie, when I was at Air St. Luke's, and transitioning over and doing all of it, it just felt at that time like it was just too much.
And those are long hours that you're doing. I mean, for listeners that don't know what the schedule is like, tell us a little bit of what those schedules are when you're saying, I'm doing all three of these things, and what that actually looks like.
Right. So with the fire department, you could work 12 to 24 or sometimes up to 48-hour shifts, depending on how much available time you had. So most of the time I was doing 24 hours at a time. And then at Air St. Luke's, I was working 12-hour shifts. So sometimes I would come off of a 24-hour shift at the fire department, go straight to Air St. Luke's, work a 12-hour shift, and then the next day I may be at Ada County on a 12 or a 24-hour shift. So sometimes those all got stacked. We really try not to do that so that you're sharp and you can focus, but occasionally those things kind of run together, and that, you know, as you know, that really is the kind of the commonality between first responders, because the pay isn't all that great. And I don't know very many other paramedics that don't have more than one job.
Right.
You know, working multiple jobs to make ends meet.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people that are not within the first responder realm, like, oh, well, you work 48 hours and then you're off the rest of the time. It's like, no, because you get paid so little at these places, you have to be working somewhere else to make up the income. But yet the personalities that we have, we are go, 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 go. And so it's not uncommon that a lot of first responders that I know, you know, especially medics or EMTs that go from working on an ambulance for 24 hours and then go to another agency the next day for a 12, and then they go back to their main agency for now another 24. Not only the hours, the lack of sleep, the emotional toll, like that starts building up.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that I had started to feel that during that transition. I just was like, man, I'm never home to see my wife. I'm working too many hours. I'm losing a little bit of the excitement of all of the stuff. So at that time, I'd still been testing for the fire department at all the local departments. And it's like I just would barely miss it. I'd end up towards the top of that list, and I remember hearing a story from you similar, where you work really hard to take these tests and you get so close and you just barely miss it.
Yep.
And then, you know, over time you just kind of lose a little bit of that excitement to keep trying and just barely miss it.
Right.
So at that time I decided, why don't I step away from the fire department? And I had gotten hired full-time at Ada County as a EMT advanced. So I was able to get my schedule under control a little bit and go to work there full-time as an EMT. And that's where things kind of shifted, and I really enjoyed 911. Running emergency calls is fun, you know, and you get to go on all kinds of different things, good and bad. You see a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
And you get really close with your partners because you're running calls, and sometimes it's the only person you have to really vent about stuff with. And that was one of the things I think that over time wore on me a little bit, was you go on these tough calls, you work these long hours, and then you get off shift, and now you're expected to be like a productive member of society immediately. I remember at one point running a pediatric cardiac arrest with my paramedic partner. So I was the EMT, which is a little bit less stressful.
Right.
But I remember coming off that and just having to go home and go right into like being a husband. And I was just like, mentally, it was like, I am not available right now. And that is something that over the course of is almost 12 years that I was in between the different departments, that wore on me over time. It's like you get off shift and you're worn out. You've sometimes run 24 or 36 straight hours and you need to like decompress. And sometimes you have something planned after a shift or something happens, or a lot of people have to go to another job, or you are in school, or you have kids at home, and now you have to go and be productive. And that is something that I think the general public really doesn't see a lot of, unless you're like a spouse or a close family member of a first responder, is that you have to figure out how to break free when you get off shift, and it's not always easy.
Right.
You know, some shifts, easy going, you don't run too many calls, or you don't have anything, you know, super critical, and you can turn that shit, you know, that switch off, and you can shift out of that mindset. But sometimes you go on those shifts and you just get crushed, and now you have to like figure out how to turn that dial. And that was something that wore on me over time, was figuring out how to do that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it too, that I think society does not realize, is that yes, you have these emergent calls, 911 calls, like the craziest, worst thing, right? We are the people that are there on their worst days. Mm-hmm. And yes, they're grateful and they're appreciative. But what you have now seen and dealt with doesn't go away. And if there's one thing that I can tell society not to do, is don't ever ask a first responder what the worst thing is that they've seen, because that does still live with them. Like, there is a lot of stuff that as first responders, we hold on to, because, you know, you just can't erase that from your brain. You try to figure out how to deal with what you've seen. And yes, this is part of our job. Like, we understand that. Like, every first responder understands, like, there's going to probably be some really shitty things that I see today, or things that I have to deal with. And that is part of my job. And I know how to handle these situations. It's the next step that we don't really get taught. And it's how do we actually deal with having seen those things?
Right.
We know how to treat. We're really good at responding. Like, first responders are really good at responding. We are not very good at being proactive.
Right.
And I think, you know, like you're expressing, it's the continual exposure that you have seen and dealt with that starts stacking up, not just that one event.
Right. Yeah. And I remember calls that still are with me today, all the way back from, you know, early on as a firefighter. And I remember a few when I was at Air St. Luke's, and most of the time it's pediatric calls. Yep. I mean, those are the ones that hit you the hardest. But I remember those affecting me, and for whatever reason, I don't know if it's the fact that I was an EMT at the time, so there wasn't nearly as much pressure per se, or responsibility on some of those calls, but I was able to kind of tuck them away. There's this, I'm sure you've heard it, but they talk about your backpack as a first responder, and starts out where you just start putting rocks in it, and they might be small rocks, but over time the backpack gets heavier and heavier. And I remember being taught that early on, and, you know, you're excited to go and run these calls. You're excited to do these things. And some of those first calls are kind of like, whoa, that, I can't believe that just happened. Like, this is something you might see in a movie or something that you might hear about. And then you're in the middle of it and you're like, oh my goodness. but I might start out as a small rock or a pebble, and over time, those just catch up to you.
Right.
And fast forwarding, I guess, I get through paramedic school, and, you know, I get through my internship, I pass and everything, get promoted, and it was like right away, started running some pretty tough calls. And I was like, man, I don't know if I was lucky to not have these as an EMT, or, you know, some paramedics don't have a whole lot of critical calls for a while, which is great. It was like, man, right off the bat, I just felt like there's a lot of stuff happening here, and I'm stressed out because I'm a brand new paramedic. I'm trying to, like, get comfortable, and I'm working, you know, long hours and running all these calls, and I don't feel like I'm, like, processing through everything. So over time, those really started to definitely add up. The backpack started to feel like it was getting more full. If we fast forward a little bit more, I ended up joining the peer support team with the county, and I feel like that experience was good and bad for me. I think it was really good because I was able to steer some of that stuff I was working through and help some of my coworkers and help create this safe space at the county, and work through some of these things. And you get people on these teams where you want to have enough people where everybody feels like they trust somebody to talk to. And I feel like it helped, but it also adds to the stuff you're dealing with. And at that time, I had just had like a really bad spree of stuff that had been going on, and I had been struggling for a while. And here I was on the peer support team, and I wasn't like getting enough of the help that I'm trying to encourage people to do themselves.
Right.
And at the time, I don't think I, it's not that I was ignoring it. I just don't think I fully realized it, how much I was struggling. And we had a little boy at home, and the work-life balance had become more difficult. Now I'm running calls for a lot of hours of the day and into the night, and I'm coming home, and it's like, okay, now I got to be a dad, and I'm really tired, and I'm not getting sleep or enough sleep after my shift, or you're trying to sleep in the middle of the day, and there's a little kid running around in the house making noise, and now it starts to stack.
Right.
And then at that time, I started working at ISU in the lab and was teaching just in the lab a day a week or a day every couple weeks, and that typically fell between my shifts. So it'd be like a 24-hour shift, come off work, go and teach paramedics for a half a day, and then go on another 24, and then have a little kid at home. So the work-life balance kind of got a little bit out of whack again, and I started to just feel like it was getting really heavy. And I think at that time I kind of said I wanted to take like a little break from the peer support team, and I just wanted to catch my breath a little bit and stepped away from teaching a little bit, just because I knew that I needed a little bit of a break.
Right.
And then I don't know if it was bad luck or if it was just things were heavy, so I wasn't like ready to deal with all the stuff, but I had four shifts over 2 weeks. So, you know, 24 on and then 24 off, the 24 on, 2 weeks in a row. And I just got crushed on every shift. It was like the busiest I've ever been in my career. And it was just, I think, just bad luck and timing. And almost the full 24 hours, all four shifts, we ran. And for whatever reason, I had more critical calls on that. And I think two or three of the four shifts, I was the only paramedic. So that adds that extra level of anything that's beyond basic, you're in the back, you're doing the charts, it's on you.
Right.
And I've been struggling already, and then this extra stress started to happen, and I started feeling it through a few of the shifts, like, man, this is bad, this is tough. And I, on the fourth shift, got a specific call that was a pediatric call, and I just remember walking out of that house, and I felt the light switch just turn off. And I'll never forget that feeling. I was just like, I don't ever want to see this or do this ever again. And I think part of the shift, I think, also happened when we had our son. It changes your perspective on how you see pediatric calls. They're hard for everybody.
Right.
But I think emotionally, like, you put yourself in that situation a little bit and you're fine in the time. And then it's like after the shift, it hits you. You're like, oh my gosh, that was terrible.
Yeah.
This shift, I felt it like in that exact moment. I knew, it's like, man, I remember walking to the ambulance, families like behind me, just completely losing it. I'm barely keeping it together. It's just a brutal call. And I get in the ambulance, have a trainee with me that day. And I'm like trying to figure out how, like, what do I teach on this? I don't know what I can teach. And I just remember, like, it was a completely silent drive back to the station. I called my wife that day and I was like, man, it's not good. Like, I think I may have just run like my last call. Like that, I don't ever want to do that again. So I'm trying to like kind of walk it off at the station, just let it go, and tones go off. So now I'm thinking about this one. We're rolling out to another one. And I remember specifically, it was like, just to someone, it was a big deal. To me in that moment, it was like a minor call. And you got to like switch gears from this like severe call to what the next emergency is. And I don't even remember running that call.
Right.
You just go on like autopilot. And like my brain's just stuck on this. And I remember getting back from that one, and I'm still just like really rattled, and tried to like get some food in me, lay down for a minute, and then another critical call comes in. And so now it's weird. Like, usually I could switch into another critical call and handle that. But for whatever reason, it was like that last one was just like sticking with me, and it made the next one 10 times worse. It just was like the stacking effect.
Right.
We got through that one, and I just knew at that point, I'm like, I can't do this. So I got through the rest of that shift, and I actually called someone that was on the peer support team and a friend, and she had been an FTO of mine, and she was also a supervisor at that time. And I just said, I need help. Like, I don't know what to do. And that was like the hardest phone call I've ever made.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, we use the word stigma a lot. It's like a trigger word, but we talk about it a lot. And there is like a stigma of being a first responder, or, you know, growing up in the house that I did with my dad, being in the military. There's a stigma, I think, in the military and first responders for getting help. You gotta be tough and not let this stuff bother you. And I just remember feeling like I'm going to get help today, or it's going to get really bad. And so I called her, and she was like my saving grace. Like, she just said, we're going to take care of you. You're going to take some time off, and I want you to see how things go. And around that time was when COVID started, on top of everything else. So I'm like really trying to like take some time for myself, recover. And then now we can't even go outside. Or I remember trying to take my son to the park, and we couldn't go to the park, you know. And it's like, you want to get outside, get some fresh air with your family, and now you can't. Now I'm stuck in the house. And I remember a day where my son, he had like some little toy, like cap gun, and he put it in his mouth, like all little kids put toys in their mouth. And it was like, I lost it. It's like, oh my gosh. Like, it was just an instant trigger for me. And I knew then, like, I was deep into it, and that I really needed to go get some help. So I actually had been seeing a gal named Lisa Johnson from time to time over some other tough calls that had happened over the course of the years. And she was great. I think she realized at that point that I should have come back sooner.
Yeah.
And so we kind of started that going again. And I felt like after, I think it had been a couple weeks, like, hey, I'm going to try to go back on shift. And the supervisor put me with another paramedic that day. And it was actually like one of my best friends. And so I felt, you know, like I feel pretty comfortable. I'm going on shift with someone that I went through paramedic school with, that we trust each other. If anyone's going to get me through this day, I'm going to get through it.
And having that knowledge too, like you're not now taking care of the EMT.
Yeah.
You have that other person with the knowledge behind that. And now every ALS call is not just your call.
Yeah.
There's some safety in there as
well.
For
sure.
Yeah.
So I got on shift and it was like an hour in. I just had this insane amount of anxiety. Like, man, what if we get another call like this? I can't do it. And I just remember fighting it for a couple hours, I was sitting at the desk, you know, looking at some old charts, and I just felt like my chest was going to burst. So I called the supervisor and I was like, I can't be here. I can't do this. So that's when I continued on into treatment with Lisa. And that's when I think the county was like, well, I think we need to take the next steps here. And at that time, the Idaho legislation had passed that PTSD could be a workers' comp claim. And it was pretty new at that time. And so we started that process. And that's kind of where things got kind of funky. Like we had COVID happening, everything shut down. And I started this process that they didn't even, like a lot of the departments didn't have paperwork to even process me through with this injury.
Right.
It was like, select a body part. I remember sitting there and I'm looking at this like skeleton. What body part did you injure? I'm like, I guess I'm going to circle the head on the thing. Cause I don't know. You know, like, what do I put on this form?
Right.
And several of the people at these agencies were like, I'm sorry. You're like one of the first cases we've seen. It may take a little bit to get you through some of this stuff and we're going to work on it really hard for you. And they did. It just naturally, it was kind of like being the guinea pig.
Right.
And that kind of, that in combination with COVID, it was just making this process hard. And now my treatments with Lisa are on a computer screen. So I'm in my house trying to like hole up in one of the rooms and I've got my kid banging on the door or running around and I'm not fully able to focus. And there was just a lot of different components, I think, that added to the difficulty of everything.
Right.
And being one of the first ones through.
So you're adding situations to an already hard circumstance.
Yeah.
Like it's not getting easier.
Yeah. And I remember at one point I was like, man, maybe I just need to take some time off. Like this is just too much. And maybe this will all just go away. Because
right.
it was frustrating. But I went and I saw the specialist that you go through this like full day of testing to make sure that this is legitimate, essentially. And I remember him looking me in the eye and he's like, do you think that you'll be able to recover and return to work? And I don't think I was ready for that question, but I think I was anticipating maybe I won't be able to do this again. And when he asked me, it's like it set in at that time. And I remember like saying no. I don't think I can do it again, but I don't know what therapy can do for me or treatment and stuff.
Right.
But I knew that I was really struggling. And there was basically a comment that came back to me like, I think you should prepare yourself that you're not going to be able to return to this line of work ever again. And that like hit me like a ton of bricks. I think mentally, I knew that's probably what was going to happen. And I think as first responders, like we're never going to admit defeat, like right. on our own. And it's almost like I needed somebody else to tell me what I knew already. And then when they told me, I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? You know,
it sets in.
This is all I've done for my whole adult life. Right. This is what I had all the plans, right? I was going to work till I was like 49 and buy some time, and I was going to be out of there. And then now I'm sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? Pretty much all my education's in this. And now I got to find something different.
And it's not like that education, it's amazing education, but it does not correlate to a lot of other jobs.
Right.
And then the other hard part is the licensing. Does not, you can't just change your paramedic licensing to say a nurse.
Right.
It just doesn't work like that. So there's opportunities are so limited, and it is almost, you have to start over.
Right. Yeah. And it started to feel like that, like, oh my gosh, my paramedic license is useless to me outside of this. Besides, like, maybe one of my family members getting hurt or something, you know.
Right.
It's great knowledge to have.
Right.
I think everyone should be an EMT, but.
Yes. Yes. It's wonderful knowledge.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, just as a bystander, you know, what do you do? How do you kind of look at the outside circumstances and help at the same time? And I think that's what a lot of first responders get into this for, is wanting to help people.
Right.
And then you are helping people, but you're also working with the bottom 10% of society. You're also seeing, you know, you are on repeat of traumatic experiences. If you have seen it, if you have dealt with it, even if you have heard the dispatch tones go out and you have prepared your mind for it, and this is something you and I have talked about, you may not have actually been to that scene or dealt with that patient, but just by what dispatch tells you, you've already ran through a call in your head.
Yeah.
And then now you get to go to the call. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not that call, you still have ran through 10 different scenarios in your head, and you've felt every single one of those scenarios in your body. And then, you know, like you have talked about, now they want you, I mean, and this is part of, yes, it is part of the job where you, they tell you, well, just forget about that call. You need to go to the next call. But we can't just forget about that call. Mm-hmm. It's still with us. It's still sticking with us. And I think with you, you know, like you had said, you don't remember that second call after the pediatric one because your mind is still envisioning what has happened. It's still processing what has happened. And you also, as a medic, always think like, could I have done something different? Mm-hmm. And that does not always pertain to the EMTs. And I think for people that are listening, there is such a drastic change between the roles of an EMT and a paramedic. And I know it annoys every single one of us when you're like, oh yeah, I'm a paramedic, and they're like, oh yeah, you're an EMT, and I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. Okay,
you're an ambulance driver.
Yeah, you're an ambulance driver. You're nobody, you know? Like, oh well, like, isn't that like what, you know, like, isn't that what like the nurses do? I'm like, no, that's fine. That's fine. But with all of this, what is it that, I mean, you at least recognize that there was something.
Yes.
The doctors recognized that there was something. What was the process after that?
Yeah, I'd like to back up just a touch. I think the number one person in my life that knew something was wrong wasn't me. It was my wife. Some of the symptoms started to show up, and when you're in it, you don't necessarily recognize it. But, you know, anger all the time, or agitation, or being in a room with a lot of things going on really started to get to me. I'm like super easily overwhelmed, and which turns to agitation or anger because it's like a self-defense mechanism. And so my wife started to notice, like, hey, you're like really abnormally angry lately, and you seem like really jumpy or anxious. And so some of these symptoms started to show up. Then I'm starting to notice them more myself because she's saying something. Then I'm going to treatment, and they're like, okay, we've got a lot to work on here. And then essentially it was assigned to me to do X amount of treatment. But where you typically probably do treatment, some departments put their people through like an actual program. This being brand new and there wasn't a lot of programs set up for first responders, at least locally at that time, was like, continue on what you're doing. Continue to see Lisa, but COVID kind of made that tricky. But really what we were working on was EMDR. And my best skill was avoidance. I did not want to face some of that stuff. I had this like crazy wall built up to protect me.
Right.
And I remember her saying multiple times, like, you need to let the process work. And I'd find a way to like talk myself out of it or take up time out of the session. And I wasn't trying to, it was just my self defense mechanism.
You had taught yourself that passively throughout all of the years.
Yep.
Of what you saw.
Yeah. So we really worked on EMDR, a new technique called brain spotting. And I found this, looks like a watch that you wear on your wrist or your ankle, and it's just subtle vibrations, and really that works on your central nervous system. And an old special forces guy actually told me to get one because he had like insomnia, horrible, severe nightmares, all that stuff, and it helped him. So I tried that as well, and that definitely started helping me. I was also having like horrific nightmares, so I'm not sleeping well. I'm waking up really upset or agitated, and sometimes I wasn't even waking up, and I was like physically responding. So all these things together, I started to feel like I was improving a little bit. I'll say one of the hardest parts about the whole thing was all the medications. And it's probably like a necessary evil to get me through some of those times, but you know, I'm now on these medications that have side effects that cause you to be worse. So I'm at home, can't go anywhere, on medications, they're making me worse. Now I'm on medications for the side effects. And it was tough. It was a really, really dark year in just a lot of different ways.
Right.
Around that time, my wife and I were wanting to try for another baby. And we struggled a lot with some infertility issues. And one of the things that we thought maybe we should try is coming off all the medications. So I actually have rheumatoid arthritis as well, and I was on medication for that. And I was on some medications for the PTSD. And I had to come off of everything, and it was really tough. It got much worse before it got better.
Right.
But I think coming off everything and being able to like really face what I was up against without something numbing me out without the meds and stuff, I think that's when I really started to get better. And around that time, COVID started to simmer out a little bit where we could start having in-person sessions again. And I started to feel like I was becoming myself a little bit more again. So it was a tricky time.
Well, and especially when you talk about, you know, the medications, because there is sometimes where people can't continue to go without those medications, mm-hmm. but there's such a lag time of one of them actually starting to take effect on you. And then, like you said, then you have all of the side effects. And yes, it's, you know, helping you get through those times, but it's also that mentality where it's like, I don't want to be on these medications the rest of my life. And I personally have heard a lot of people that don't like to get the help because they don't want to be medicated.
Right.
And just because you may need that medication for a short amount of time, like, let's get you through that little bit of the lull. Like, yeah. Let's push you to that place where then you can feel at a safe place in your life. Where you're like, hey, I'm going to actually come off all of these medications, see what it does to me personally. You coming back and feeling like yourself because you're not numb. And that's what happens a lot of time is on those medications, they just give you no emotion. Where it's like, instead of being angry or bitter or, you know, agitated, we're just not going to have you be anything. Well, that also takes away all of your positive emotions. you know, feeling happy, feeling joyful, feeling grateful for things. You're just a body at that point, mm-hmm. just moving through your day. And I think coming off of those, you know, medications sounds like that is what has also helped you, you know, like you're taking that control. You're taking that, hey, it got me through what I needed it to get me through. But like, let my mind process what it needs to process. Cause when I'm numb, it's not doing that either. And there's no progress in that.
Yeah. I definitely wasn't myself. And I knew it, which was the hard part. It's like, man, I'm not myself. And that almost made me feel worse. But to your point, I think if I had been a little bit more proactive about getting help, and it's easy, hindsight's always 20/20.
Right.
I think you don't necessarily know it when you're in it, but I think you have to listen to your body, listen to your family and your spouse. And I think my wife played a huge role in like pushing me to get the help that I needed. And I think that it's important to recognize that for other first responders that are out there, like listen to your family members that know you the best.
Right.
And for those family members that may be listening, I think it's important to either mention it so that maybe they will see it themselves, or mention it to somebody that they trust that's a fellow first responder or on a peer support team or something, so that somebody is aware and can be watching out for that person.
Right.
And I think if I had maybe listened to my body sooner, I could have gotten help sooner, and maybe you don't need any of the medications. And there's so many cool resources out there now that I'm sure some of them were there too, and I was going through this stuff, but I didn't know about them. But there's just a lot of cool resources out there. There's different techniques. You don't use medications, and I think being proactive is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that helped me the most through everything was exercise. And they always preach that a lot, you know, go out, get a lot of exercise, don't drink alcohol, that kind of stuff. When you're in it and you're feeling like emotionally charged from these calls, though, you get off shift, and I don't know about you, but there's a lot of days where I'm like, I don't feel like working out today.
Right.
Like, I don't have the energy.
And I think that's what it comes down to, is when you don't feel like you have the energy, that's the last thing that you want to do, because you're trying to get yourself just through the day.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't even think about adding now exercise on top of it. And right. It could be as simple as going for a walk, you know, like, and it's hard because, like you said, it's the hindsight of things, where I do know now, like when I'm in a shitty mood and going and working out, I promise myself, like, I'll be better afterwards, mm-hmm. you know? But when you are in that state where it's like, do I sleep for 5 minutes or do I get outside for 5 minutes? Sleeping is usually the one that you're like, I'm just going to lay here. Like, I'm not exerting any energy. And this is, it's like a safety thing for us, right? We're like, what can we do the least resistance? And probably just sitting here is the least resistance. And I think too, you know, like you said, there are a lot of resources out there. Like, we, you know, have, especially here in our area, like the emergency responders healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. Like, any first responder and their spouses can go in and get regular, you know, healthcare. They can go in and get mental health care. They can go in and have that as their regular doctor. There's also so many different modalities of the therapy, the counseling, getting somebody to that point and over that hurdle and kind of breaking that that wall down that you have. I will say, from, you know, my situation just recently within, you know, my family, it's hard. Like, it's not easy being the person where you're trying to bring the light to them. You know, it's like, they have to make that decision. You have to be there to support them, you know, and it sounds like your wife was phenomenal in that. Like, I give her huge kudos, because I know a lot of wives too that are like, I've given up. Like, my husband's just angry. I don't want to be around him. That usually, you know, results in divorce. And then you just have angry people all over. And I think just my draw to this conversation is maybe, right? Like maybe getting help earlier could have saved your career. It may not have. Like right. We'll never know that. But I think it's the understanding of like when you're at that point, like ask for help.
Yeah.
Like when you know something's not right, like ask for help. And I think just in the first responder world is like it's inevitable. Like I think we like to think that it's not going to happen to us or like, oh, like I'm not going to be one of those salty medics or, you know, like I'm not going to, you know, like, oh, it's because they've been in it for so long. It's like, yeah, exactly. If you want to continue to be in this for a long time, you have to take care of yourself, especially with the schedule, especially with, you know, the things that we see and being more proactive and pushing them of like, hey, that may have been an easy shift, but like go to yoga, okay. Like go to meditation, you know, even if you don't feel like you need it, your brain needs it.
It's hard too to like eat healthy and do healthy things when you're a first responder. I found it more difficult too as a paramedic than when I was in the fire service too. I think there's definitely a difference. You know, you're really encouraged to exercise as a firefighter. They try to make sure that you get that time to do that on shift. As a paramedic, there's a lot of days where it's just too busy and you're eating whatever you can on the fly. And a lot of times it's not the healthiest thing. And that also does not help your mental state when you get off shift, when you just ate a bunch of food that you probably wouldn't normally eat and you haven't slept well and you haven't exercised. So I think getting some sun, getting out and exercising in whatever way, I think is really important.
Yeah.
And through the treatment and stuff, there wasn't anything else to do because it was COVID, but I started exercising a lot and it helped a ton.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What is it, you know, obviously besides the anger, like how did your wife try to like tell you like, hey, you're not acting the same? Like,
I think she actually like really pretty patiently watched some of my interactions with my son. Like I've always wanted to be a dad. Like I was so excited when we found out we were having a boy. Cause I'm like, man, I'm going to be a boy dad. I can't wait for this stuff. And I was just like irritated by him all the time, which was not normal. And so I think she started to see these interactions and she's like, man, this just doesn't seem right. And she would mention it to me like, hey, you're really getting like bothered by him a lot. Like what's going on? Or she had known at that point too, with some previous calls that I had been on that I needed to go get some help with. She knew from some of those kind of what some of the signs and symptoms were. And so she would kind of keep her eye on me in that way. And it's really hard for our spouses and what they go through. And they just get to be on a receiving end of our bad moods when we get off shift or whatever else. And it's hard because they don't like legitimately understand our perspective because they can't. Right.
Right.
And that was always really hard for me, was to not have that connection with not only her, but you know, my son, he couldn't understand. He's too little, but some of my extended family, even like my family that's in the military, it's just different. You're seeing these things and doing these things like in your backyard, like on the street you drive on every day.
Yeah.
And it's different. And so sometimes it just felt like your only outlets were other paramedics and everybody's got their own grumbles and their own things, their own stories to tell. And so sometimes it felt like, man, I can't escape it. There's like not a lot of other people out here that understand. And so that I think was a component, but my wife was always really good at listening. She would listen to the calls that I was willing to tell her about. Sometimes right. I didn't want to tell her about them because I didn't want her to know. But she was really good at being understanding and receptive to that. And I think that's important to be able to have that outlet if that's what you want with your, you know, with your spouse.
Yeah. Yeah. I know some spouses, like they do not talk about anything about work. Like they come in the door, nothing is spoken about. there can be some positives of that. There can also be some negatives of that because you're not expressing anything. And then, you know, especially with us first responders, like sarcasm is our quickest and easiest way to get through something. Yeah. You know, like I could not tell you how many really, really shitty calls has happened. And the first thing you go to is humor. Like yeah, that is,
sure.
It's a safety thing. And then, right. Like you want to do something with all of the people off of shift. And it usually involves alcohol. And then you start drinking and then you're like, oh my gosh, yeah. Like this happened on shift and like this happened and this is what I did. And then you just start bantering about it. And that is a way to kind of open up and express of what has gone on, but then you're still continuing to kind of fester with it and like haven't actually fully processed it. And I think it is, you know, a lot of people that listen don't understand the difference between the firefighters, the paramedics, the police, EMTs, and paramedics. Like there's so many different, the structure is different. 911 versus interfacility is different. You know, it also comes down to, like you said, like you are just going from call to call to call. And it may be something as simple as a fender bender, right? Like, and you go, you check them out. They're totally fine. Don't need to go to the hospital. Okay. Then you go to, you know, grandma's not breathing and deal with that. And then you get done with that call. And then now it can go back to something of, you know, picking the next granny up from the floor. Like there's such a diverse spectrum of this job that I think people like you and I absolutely love and we thrive in. Mm-hmm. But it also, for us, you have to switch your mind that quick and your thought process that quick. But then like, what are we doing to take care of ourselves because we have to do that?
Yeah.
You know, like there is a lot of that within, you know, the police officers or, you know, the fire guys, but to the extent of what we are doing just isn't as grand as that.
Yeah. There's definitely some differences. I think naturally in a 911 system where you're on a transport ambulance, I mean, locally here, there's a lot less of us than there are fire departments. So mm-hmm. you're going to run more calls. You just naturally are. And it's the shifts that you just get crushed the whole time. Like you said, it might not be critical, but it's like, okay, I haven't eaten in like 12 hours. And that's not every shift. I mean, right. Some shifts you get to rest and it's great. But it's those ones that wear you down that over time take their toll.
Right.
For sure. So,
right.
I guess where I, one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit was just not just encouraging people to get help, but some of the signs and symptoms, which we talked about some of, but there's, I think people that are sitting there like worried, if I go get help, am I going to lose this part of me? Am I going to lose my career? And I've had discussions with a number of people through various departments around the valley. And, you know, that the common theme that I've seen from all of them is they want to get help, but they're afraid to because, A, what am I going to look like to my coworkers for getting help? And B, am I going to lose my job? And this is all I know, and I'm terrified. And I felt that way too. And I didn't just go and be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go get help. I had to be forced into it, basically, because I knew that I was that low. My concern is for a lot of my friends around the valley and for other first responders is that they saw what I went through, and then now I'm not a paramedic anymore.
Right.
And I can't go back to it, and I can't be a first responder or teach. And I think they're worried, like, is that going to happen to me if I get help? And I don't want people to feel like I went and got help and they just took everything. I think I knew how bad I was. I don't think deep down, I had the desire to see that anymore. Like, I still remember that light switch feeling.
Right.
And I was terrified, still would be, to be in that situation again. But there's, I think, people that want to get help and want to return, and that is a perfectly reasonable thing. And I've seen a number of friends give in, go get some help, and be, like, so thankful that they finally did it. And they're back at work like it never happened. And that's not everybody's outcome. My outcome isn't everybody's outcome. But I think being afraid of losing something, I think you're either going to lose that or yourself if you don't take care of yourself over time.
Right.
It's just, it's one or the other that's going to happen. So that was like my biggest concern, is I don't want people to see what I went through and then not go get help because they're afraid to lose their jobs.
Right. And I think that, you know, that definitely speaks volumes to you being able to help those other first responders and say, like, hey, this was my situation, but, like, that doesn't have to be your situation. And it's not going to be. Like,
right.
How they deal with it, how far along they go with it. Like, and it also sounds like you had that personal choice of, like, I also don't really want to see that again. Some people just need kind of like a reboot of, like, hey, like, I'm still willing to do these things, but, like, I need to clear, you know, what's in my brain before I can continue to do it again.
Right.
I actually believe it was Lisa Johnson that told us the analogy of basically our brains being like a sponge. And, you know, if you have the tap water on and it's, you know, filling, yes, it's going to fill that sponge. And kind of, you know, therapies and counseling and, you know, doing what you want to do for yourself is wringing that sponge out, right? Like, taking away from the water, wringing that sponge out. It can now accept more water again. But it's when we don't take that time away and we don't work on ourselves that then the sponge is filled. The water is continuing to just overflow of it, and the sponge isn't doing its purpose anymore. And I think, you know, with you getting to help those other first responders, like, you're now getting to help them wring their sponge out. Like, you're getting to help them understand. And I think it's kind of our headstrong nature in first responders to, like, no, I'm good. Like, I can do it myself. It's like, I'm sure you can, but, like, we need to lean on other people. And getting that. And thank you for saying that, like, your situation is not going to be everybody else's situation.
Right.
Like, that's also the hope of these podcasts and talking to people like you and talking to people like Jared that are in that field that have got taken out of it. But that doesn't mean that everybody else's has to. And, like, hey, before this does happen or this could happen, like, let's get you help before you get to that point. Like, we know that these are the projections if we don't get help, because we've seen it. Like, why don't we step in way further ahead of the problem and prevent it and not respond to it?
Yeah, I agree for sure. I think there's a component, too, for those of us that don't return to the job, where it took, like, a long time to feel like that wound was gone. Like, there's, like, a hole. Like, this is, like, a huge part of my life. And they always say, like, don't let your job define you, but I felt like that was impossible as a paramedic. Like, I was like, I'm a paramedic. Who are you? I'm a paramedic, you know, or I'm a firefighter or whatever it was, because we're just passionate about our work. And so when I lost that part of me, like, that was hard, and it still is hard. And I spent almost 12 years trying to earn everybody's respect at all the various departments and different levels. And then in, like, 1 second, it's gone. And so trying to, like, heal from that is a totally different part of PTSD. Like, PTSD is its thing. And then I have to, like, heal from losing this, like, whole part of me, and a lot of friends that go with that, you know, in a sense of, like, the work part and the respect part, and you just lose that. And so that took a long time to get where I felt okay about it. And then I had to like relearn how to sleep. And that's still a work in progress. But
I was saying, that will always be a work in progress.
Yeah.
I think it's also like I still to this day, like I see medics, I see fire trucks. I'm like, ooh, where are they going? Like, what's happening? Like, there's still that's still a part of you, you know, like it's still an interest because it's also like those are your people. Like being a first responder is not just having like coworkers, like they're your family, like the doctors, the nurses, the security staff, like they are your family because you're not only seeing them all the time, like you also know that those are the people that will have your back when something goes down wrong, you know? And I think that is a huge thing for you to say is like, you have lost some of that. And I, you know, I hope that you can get that back because it's like, those are the people that you're on the side of the interstate. Like they have you back, you, they have your back there. Like, why can't they have your back here too?
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's just the bringing up these conversations, having these conversations, you know, there's not a lot of people within our industry having these tough conversations of like, this happened to me. And I give you such big kudos to being like, I'm ready to tell my story. You know, like I'm ready to share my side of it because that's also not easy. It's being very vulnerable. It's bringing up all those past traumas. It's also bringing up all those past conversations and like the process of that. But my hope is that like this can be a part of your process and be like, you know what, now I feel like I'm at a point to share my side of it. And like, I want it to be a helpful side of it.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend recently about this and you talked about people having your back. Right. And I think I had that when I was going through everything too. There was a couple of variabilities, you know, one was COVID. So no one was together.
Right.
No one was like, it was all phone calls or texts at that point. You're not going to events or you're not going to like friend gatherings. And so that was a part of it. And then I think naturally it's like a self-defense mechanism. Like you kind of like hide in the corner a little bit. And I just was like, man, I'm going through all this. Like I feel stupid at the time, but that it was the right place for me to be. And I shouldn't have felt that way, but it's just, I think naturally sometimes how you feel that way, but I still had everybody's support. And it's really important to support each other when people are willing to go get that help because it's a hard thing to ask for.
Right. So. All right. Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else that you tell us what you're actually doing now? Now that you're not doing medic, right? Like what's the positive coming out of this?
So kind of while I was still in treatment, some family and myself bought a small business where we sell automotive detail supplies. And I've been running that ever since. And it was totally different than what I did before. I've had to learn a lot in a short period of time, but I am having fun with it. And I'm hoping that it's going to continue to grow and be successful. And it's a different kind of a grind. Yeah. It's now I can't like leave that for 4 days, 5 days, whatever, and come back to it. It's every day all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely is a huge switch where you're like, gosh, like knowing that you do have 4 days off and you can completely be off from your job to now somebody's reaching out to you something or like, hey, you have, you know, somebody reaches out to you for the supplies. You have to be on top of it.
Yeah.
You know, I totally get it. It's a different kind of grind.
A lot of different fires to put out all the time.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, Connor, I do appreciate you coming on, sharing your story, talking with us, and just, you know, being able to kind of express where you have came from in the helps to help other people. So I appreciate that so very much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Yes. So listeners, definitely head over to Apple Podcasts. Leave me a review. You can also head to the website, which is rawthoughtspodcast.com. See everybody's contact information. You can reach out to me on there as well. And we'll see you next week for another episode. Thanks, guys. Thank you for tuning into the show today. Your feedback is very important to me. If you could leave a review as well as follow me on Instagram at rawthoughts.podcast and email in at m.rawthoughts@gmail.com if you have any guest suggestions.